This is also very important because of the fact that accreditation issues tend to kind of make issues of accessibility and engagement with the human rights mechanisms of the UN only opened to maybe very specific civil society organizations. But through the stakeholders report, through kind of mobilizing at the national level, etc., it allows for a much more broad-based set of inputs to come in to a UN mechanism. So those were the two kind of main responses. We also asked what they view needs the most improvement in order to make the UPR meaningful to them. Now, by far, the biggest response was the full involvement and genuine consultation process at the national level with all relevant stakeholders. Now, the response to this was kind of twofold. Firstly, it was that in most countries in Asia, national consultation was taking place to take inputs into the national report. Now, somebody had asked earlier on whether or not the national report reflects some of the priorities of women's organizations. I think by and large, civil society felt that the national report did not reflect any of the priorities of civil society, whether it be the women's group or any other group. And that sometimes those consultations were taking place really as to tick a box, you know, that we conducted consultations and we can report on this in Geneva, that we conducted these consultations. At the same time, though, civil society groups really felt that these consultations were extremely important and necessary. And you will find that when you speak with a lot of the groups who are now submitting their second submissions to the UPR for the second cycle, that that the biggest value that they feel of the UPR process is that it opens up these channels for consultations with their state authorities and with relevant ministries to talk specifically about human rights. In many countries in Asia, this is unprecedented. They had never been able to actually sit down with the Ministry of Justice, for example, to talk specifically about their human rights obligations. And the UPR allows that to happen. So there's both a challenge and an advantage to this. And then the second overwhelming response, of course, was that the UPR, in order to be more meaningful, needs far more effective follow-up to the UPR recommendations. Now, in terms of follow-up, we then asked, what should be the ways and methods for effective follow-up to these UPR recommendations? Now, you have to understand that this questionnaire took place at the end of the first cycle. So at that particular moment in time, there was a view that states need to translate these recommendations into national action plans in consultation with all the relevant stakeholders, including parliamentarians, as well as national institutions and civil society. In addition to that, the second highest response was that while the state needs to translate these recommendations, the Human Rights Council itself needs to perhaps think about establishing its own follow-up procedures for a midterm or periodic update. At the moment, there is a practice of submitting midterm reports on a midterm implementation status. However, this is not compulsory. Many members of civil society believe that a midterm report ought to be compulsory, and that there ought to be some kind of a dialogue or a debate on that. However, I mean, in order for that to happen, you would need sort of a political decision to come from the Human Rights Council. And during the time of the Human Rights Council's review, which was in 2011, this proposal was rejected by the Human Rights Council. So we don't have any kind of an official follow-up procedure by the Human Rights Council. Technically, though, according to the rules of procedures for the second cycle of the UPR, the second and subsequent cycles need to be focusing a lot more on follow-up.